Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Series 3 of Humans of Excess Manchester with me, Clint Boone. This series is sponsored by our friends at Safer Roads GM, helping us to keep ourselves and each other safe on the roads of Manchester. This week I'm joined by legendary punk poet and Salfordian icon, Dr. John Cooper Clarke. He talks about his time at school during the post-war period.
When I was 13, I wanted to be a professional poet because obviously I was the best at it, even though the competition was fierce in our class under Mr. Malone.
And he describes how he always wanted to be a professional poet.
I've always tried to take it into the entertainment business, you know, a place where you wouldn't expect to find poetry.
Gives a great pleasure to welcome to Humans of Excess Manchester a chap who, when he first arrived on our TV screens back in the 1970s, it was like nothing we'd seen before. He looked like Bob Dylan. He had the energy of Beep Beep the Roadrunner, and he had a way with words that was magical, and he's still with us all these years later, Mr. John Cooper Clarke. Dr. John Cooper Clarke, welcome to Humans of Excess Manchester.
Thank you very much, Clint.
We're in the luxurious surroundings of the Lowry Hotel.
Lowry Hotel, yeah.
And you were born like a stone's throw away from here, weren't you?
Not far, Higher Broughton.
Higher Broughton?
Yeah, not that far.
Were you born in the hospital or in the...
Old Hospital, yeah, near Langworthy Road, yeah.
What are your memories of childhood around here?
I spent a lot of time in Hope Hospital, actually. I was born there, and then a few years later, I returned there as a tubercular patient.
Were you poorly for a long time?
Yeah, quite a while. And, of course, it was the worst air in Europe at the time, you know, given the activities in Trafford Park back in our industrial heyday.
Yeah.
And I was sent to live in Rhyl, which was then a thriving holiday resort serving Liverpool and beyond.
It was paradise, wasn't it, Rhyl?
It was all right then. Shit going on.
Yeah. What else do you remember? What are your standout memories of being a child in Salford? Was it a dirty, smoky place back then?
Yeah, I used to hang around in Oddsall a lot because my cousins Sid and Frankie lived there. So, we used to, they used to come, they had a TV before us and we had an indoor bathroom. So we had this trade-off where we went round to their house at 9 o'clock on a Monday night to watch Wagon Train, and they could all come to our place for a bath.
Amazing. We had an outside toilet. I was born in 59, grew up in Oldham in the 60s.
Uh-huh.
We had an outside toilet for most of the 60s, I think.
Well, I was always lucky with the indoor bathroom facilities because I never lived in a house.
Right.
Until now. This is the first house I've ever lived in. I've always lived in apartments.
Right. You settled down in Colchester, of all places, recently, haven't you?
Yeah.
Is that just looking for somewhere a bit peaceful?
No, not really. It's an army garrison town. I think peaceful is you're going to have to look somewhere else.
The party town.
It's a pretty lively place because of that. And it's all down to a woman. The woman who is now my wife.
Evie?
Yes, indeed, yeah. Evie.
Evie.
The lovely Evie.
How did you get on at school? Were you a scholarly sort of kid?
I didn't like school. I hated it from the word go.
Yeah.
So in a way, kind of getting tuberculosis was a kind of a godsend because I'd already learnt to read a bit and then I could sort of choose my own reading matters, given that I spent most of my time alone in a holiday resort.
Yeah.
I don't think people would do this now, but I was turfed out of the house at 10 a.m., and I wasn't expected to be back until tea time. And all that time in between was entirely entirely my area.
was reading a big thing for you?
Massive. I've always been a bookworm.
What about poetry? When did that come into your world?
Very early on, at school when I was about 12, we had a particularly inspirational teacher called John Malone. And it was a secondary modern school, Catholic secondary modern school, St. Thomas's in High Broughton. And he had a real flair for extending his interest in mainly Victorian romantic poetry. Every summer holiday, every September, he would return to the school with a new injury. He was big on outdoor pursuits, so he didn't have any of that baggage of the nerd or the Nancy boy. Everybody's seen him as quite a tough little fella, but he had this weakness, as I say, for the opiated poetry of Edgar Allan Poe and people like John Keats, which he conveyed to the entire class, astonishingly. It wasn't just me that got into it. He kind of fostered a hothouse, competitive atmosphere of poetry whereby even the toughest kids in the class were kind of... had always had their nose in a dictionary. Yeah, it's remarkable. I don't think that would happen now. There's a great deal of... erroneous mythology about the nature of secondary modern schools in that immediate post-war period. I think it's seen as a scrap heap, a social scrap heap where they send the industrial cannon fodder of tomorrow, to do menial latrine diggers and the like, It wasn't like that, not at all. We were never made to feel like we were getting a second-rate education, We were expected to do well. And even if we were being prepared for a life in industry, at that point, industry was becoming very technological and very complicated, and one had to really be literate in order to cut it, even in a factory. Yeah. So it was a great standard of education. In fact, I'm amazed. I watch University Challenge, and I can't believe what they don't know. I'm like, Christ, I knew that when I was 8.
So you were born, was it 4 years after the war, the Second
World
War?
Yeah, about 49.
Did you feel, as a kid, did you still feel that, the aftermath of what just happened? Did you sense that?
What, the war? Everybody was obviously very interested in it on account of our parents were involved. Yeah, a great deal about it, and those movies were all coming out, Reach for the Sky with Kenneth Moore, the Dam Busters, the 50s, the late 40s and 50s right through till really the 70s. Well, they're still making them now, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Second World War movies and, lest we forget.
What about music? When did that come knocking on your door?
Music really never appeared in our place until my uncle Dennis finished his national service in the RAF, where he served in Cyprus and Jordan and those kind of trouble spots in the far-flung reaches of the decaying empire. So when he moved in, before that, the only music I heard really was on the radio. But when my uncle Dennis came to live with us, he brought his collection of American popular music, pre-rock and roll, so it would have been the late Doris Day, sadly. I was a great fan of hers. Doris Day, Ella Fitzgerald, Peggy Lee, Sinatra, Dean Martin, Mel Torme, people like this. I loved all American popular music, even before rock and roll, but then, Elvis, wow.
What age were you when this happened, when he moved in with all these amazing records?
Would have been about 1954, maybe, right. Yeah, I guess. I'm bad with dates. But about then, and he brought some great albums with him.
Yeah, and then 50s rock and roll happened, didn't it? It changed your
life. Yeah, he wasn't into rock and roll at all. He was kind of a little bit older than that. He thought it was vulgar and noisy. He liked proper singers, Nat King Cole, but just... give you the list.
Yeah.
So he was quite antipathetic to rock and roll, but naturally, it was I was ready for that.
Because you're an absolute aficionado when it comes to 50s rock and roll music.
Well,
encyclopedia.
I'll tell you what, though, there was music that sort of were a pointer to rock and roll even then, so it wasn't kind of right out of the blue. I mean, Elvis, obviously, right out of the blue. If you told me he'd dropped from a superior planet, I would believe you. But we'd had sort of inklings of the rock and roll approach with records by Louis Prima. and Lewis Jordan and the Timpani Five, you know, boogie woogie stuff, you know, rock and roll in all but name, really.
Was that like, I mean, to me, punk was the moment that changed my path in life. Did the 50s rock and roll stuff change your journey? Did it have the same impact back then?
Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously, your priority, get a guitar. But I can't convey how rare it was to even see a guitar. Yeah, it was certainly a big event, especially, you know, Elvis. I mean, Bernard Manning, he started life, his show business career, as a singer. I think it was with the Phil Moss Orchestra. I could be wrong about which, but it was a dance band in the tail end of the dance hall era. You know, every band was on the American model, so they would have a vocal group, a close harmony vocal group, which usually comprised two men and a woman. The two men, one would specialise in tender romantic ballads, while the other one would do the more raunchy kind of stuff. Yeah. You know, as I say, Lewis Jordan, or maybe a Brooke Benton. He was around at the time, Brooke Benton. People who got involved with the soul scene. They were kind of around in that pre-rock and roll era, and occasionally you heard them. But getting back to the Phil Moss Orchestra and Bernard, he was one of the group, you know, but he was the one that specialised in the more raunchy Brooke Benton type stuff. One of the songs I heard him, I used to hear him, it was a song called Kiddio by Brooke Benton. It was vaguely a kind of a hoochie coochie man structure, I think. Ba bam, ba bam, one of them, if I remember rightly. Mm. Anyway, the point is, this is how astute Bernard was and how plugged in. You know, the Phil Moss, whichever orchestra it was he sang with, they had bookings for about 2 years in advance. You know, they didn't have a night off for 2 years, you know, and they're on the bus. Suddenly, Bernard pipes up, goes up to the governor. He says, I'll work my notice. I'll honour these gigs. But after that, pay me up. I'm getting out of this business. I'm going to open my own club. I'm getting out of this business. It's finished. Mm. He said, this is finished, meaning dance bands. And they were all like, what are you talking about? Don't be a fool. You know, we booked up 2 years in advance, blah, blah, blah. What's brought about this sudden change of heart? And he said, it's all over for this kind of music. Haven't you heard that Elvis Presley? He'd heard Heartbreak Hotel somewhere.
And he knew what was coming
and
next.
And quite rightly figured, yeah, this is it. And that's when he bought the Embassy Club. Yeah. I think it had been a snooker hall or something. And he bought it, knocked down rate. The rest is history.
There's a famous bit of film footage where Tony Wilson interviews you at Salford Tech when you're working as a... Were you like a lab technician or something?
Yeah, but a lab technician, that ain't as sort of involved as it sounds. That was the job title of anybody who wore a white coat and yet wasn't qualified to be a lecturer.
So did you start there? Did you study there first, or did you go
no,
there?
No, I never went to any college. I never studied anywhere.
Right.
Apart from when I was a printer, I did day release at Sackville Street when it was Manchester Art College, doing typographic design, but that wasn't full time. It was part of an arrangement to do with the apprenticeship that I was serving.
How did you end up on stage? I mean, doing your poetry, when did that start?
Doing the poetry, well, it started, I did a little bit of it in the late 60s, actually, at a club called Mr. Smith's.
Remember that, yeah.
And I got a kind of residency there that went into the 70s, you know, I had this residency. And I was pulling pretty good money, you know, and all I had to do really was write. And that's when I was very much a local person. I was writing stuff, you know. It's when I read Salome. In fact, I did one of my early shows was at, in fact, the first place that where I got actual money was at the Embassy Club. and what swung it, I remember talking, I had to do an audition for the aforementioned Bernard Manning. And I was saying, what do you do, Linland? So I'm like, poetry, Mr. Manning, you know. Oh, they don't like poetry here. They can't read half of the fuckers. So I'm like, no, but it's not like, nothing highfalutin, Mr. Manning. So I give him a bit. I'd just written Salome Maloney, El Supremo of the Ritz. So I had it in my back pocket. I thought, he's going to like this. He must have played there with the Phil Moss Orchestra because he did all the Mecca places, you know. So that must have been his second home at one point. So I thought, he's going to like this. I let him with that one with the F word in it. It was like, you know, what was it? When the music stopped. She was lying on the deck. She fell off her stiletto heels and broke her fucking neck. I thought, that's going to get him, if anything is, you know what I mean? So I said, well give us a demo. So I give him that verse, you know, when the music stopped, she's lying on the deck, fell off her stiletto heels and broke her fucking neck. So he gave it a bit of a chuckle. He says, yeah, I like that. All right, then I'll give you a chance. You know what I mean? But it was the F word and the reference to the Ritz that got me the gig, not the fact that I was a poet.
This is way before punks, because when punk came along, it was the perfect vehicle for you at the time, wasn't it? But pre that, were you just this isolated character doing this stuff, or was there other people?
Yeah,
like
I was isolated, but I always wanted to. I mean, I don't. You know, when I was 13, I wanted to be a professional poet because I was the best at it, even though the competition was fierce in our class under Mr. Malone. I mean, obviously, I was the best. So therefore, I kind of took my gift, honed it into a skill. And then made it my profession. Three-step, bish, bash, bet, one, two, three, like that. But it wasn't as easy as I'm making it sound. Like I say, you know, I'd envisaged entering the world of cabaret, which was a flourishing area in Manchester at that time, you know. Places like Jerry Harris's Piccadilly Club, the New Luxor Club, the New College Theatre Club, Rafters, Sinatra's in Failsworth. You know, the place was full of it. Madam, what's his name? Fufu Lamar's. Yeah. Fufu's Palace.
And the Ranch.
Those sort of places. And those places, I think there was a couple of places owned by... There was a drag mafia then, weren't they? All the club owners seemed to have a sideline in drag acts. Jackie Carlton, I'm thinking. Or Bunny Lewis, Jackie Carlton. And, of course, Fufu. Frank Lamar, and they seemed to have an iron grip on the cabaret scene at the time. But there were many, many, many cabaret clubs, so I thought, you know, having established that, you know, that it's not impossible to do this stuff in that world, having done the worst, you know, the worst of them all, if you want to say that, the Embo, you know, I figured any of these other town centre places would be a doddle. As long as I kept it kind of, threw a few gags in and didn't keep it, you know, wasn't too serious. I mean, these were places of entertainment. I wasn't trying to, you know, there was nothing didactic about it. So I've always kind of approached poetry as a branch of the, you know, art, yeah, but as a, you know, I've always tried to take it into the entertainment business, you know, a place where you wouldn't expect to find poetry. And I made that incongruity work for me. And later on, I applied that to the world of punk rock. At first, I just took my existing repertoire and did it at triple speed. But it was Howard Devoto's idea that I got involved doing shows with the Buzzcocks and things. But I did like punk rock, you know. My introduction to it was via the Ramones, who I still think are, I mean, can't be bettered for me. I love that band.
Perfect pop group.
Sensational.
Did you get to meet the Ramones?
About 78 times.
They're a great band, weren't they?
Fabulous. They used to say, you know, when we were here last year, we were on for 45 minutes, and now we've finished in half an hour. We're getting better all the time. Speed was everything.
Were you a teddy boy then from pretty early on?
No, I was too young. But I did see them around, you know. Higher Broughton was Teddy Boy Central, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Bit of a mod, though, yeah.
Yeah, I was a mod. That was really the only youth tribe I've ever really been a part of. And even then, we used to deny being mods. As soon as mod turned into targets on the back of Parkers, we called ourselves stylists. It was all about snobbery and, you know, not being like everybody else.
When you started putting your poetry to music, whose idea was that?
Yeah, that wasn't my idea. I've always thought poetry should stand on its own, really. You know, it should have its music should be built in at the writing stage. So I've never been entirely convinced of the efficacy of putting poetry with music. I was taken along with it because, you know, all that baggage about the beatniks, you know, and poetry and jazz. And I did do a few jazz clubs as well in Manchester early on, the Club 43, the Black Lion, the Bodega, you know, places like that, beatnik joints. So they had this, it was always this kind of poetry and jazz thing that, but I never thought it really. I always think, you know, poetry is music.
Mm.
Some of my stuff with music is more successful than others, but, you know, wasn't my idea, no.
You did some work with Linton Kwesi Johnson, didn't you?
Yeah, I went on tour with him in around 1981.
Yeah, I saw you at the Ritz.
The Ritz we did, yeah. Yeah, that was a good tour because we were the hottest tickets in town, poetry-wise. Back then, you know, there really was only us two.
Soon after that, when the punk thing died off a bit and you sort of disappeared a little bit from the mainstream limelight, and you had a couple of bad years where you...
10 of them.
10 bad years.
15, maybe.
Can we talk about how bad did it get when you were an addict?
Well, I just kind of dropped out of it all, you know. It's that shit's the centre of your universe. I didn't write any poetry and... But at the same time, I always worked. I had to, you know, I was living a very feral existence, hand to mouth, you know. I had to have money in order to get well on a daily basis. So I never stopped doing gigs. It's just that I stopped writing new shit.
There were a couple of crucial moments a few years later when you got... The day you found out that Sopranos were going to use one of your tunes, the day that you found out the Arctic Monkeys were going to do
fabulous.
Something...
Plan B,
yeah, the film. How good did you feel on a day like that? It was like Christmas
sensational.
Day.
Sensational. It was the thing that, you know, made it happen just at the right time when I was starting to write again.
Yeah.
So I really have been luckier than I probably deserve, you know. You know, not many people have two bites of a cherry, you know. And it's not like I'm a legacy act either. You know, I'm far more successful now than I was back then, you know, in the first place. You know, you had to sell a lot of records to get into to make an impression in those days. And, you know, I was a bit of a sideshow, let's face it. But, you know, I'll go along with the mythology that, you know, the return of Johnny Clark. But, you know, really, I've never been this high profile, really.
The omnipresent Johnny Clark.
That's it, the ubiquitous please, no.
You got to work with another one of my heroes, Hugh Coymel. You did a brilliant album.
Yeah,
I
loved that. That was a great opportunity, you know. And, because I love to sing, that's why I drink.
It's a great album.
I love to sing, and that was a great opportunity. He already had the tracks done, and I read the repertoire, and I already knew all the lyrics to those songs, and it was a great experience. Left up to me, that would have never happened. So thanks, H.
He's good, isn't he? He's a gentle soul as well. I got to meet him a few years ago. Lovely bloke. In fact, he introduced me to Rhubarb Tea.
To who?
Rhubarb Tea. Is it Red Bush Tea?
Oh, that South African non-caffeinated tea.
I'm thinking this is the guy that used to watch on Top of the Pops in 1977 and be scared of him because he looked like he'd just bite your head off. But he was just a proper gentle soul, Hugh Coymel, ex-frontman of the Stranglers. And we were privileged, the Sparrow Carpets. You did a little collaboration with us on a track that is possibly the last single that we'll ever release. But you did a track called Let You Down, which is one of my
finest
moments.
That's right, yeah.
Gorgeous.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you, man. Thank you. Let's talk about Manchester. I know you're from Salford originally, but the two are intrinsically linked. Try and describe the spirit of Manchester.
Well, I've not lived here for 30 years. You've got to remember, Clint, you know, that when I left, it wasn't the rock and roll city that it is today. Not so much, though, anyway. The Manchester I remember is really, I suppose, quite different to how it is now.
What do you think of the development that you see? Now, when you look out the window, literally, the place is changing every month.
Yeah, I was amazed when I went down Cross Lane about 4 years ago, and it doesn't go all the way from Broad Street to the docks anymore. You know, somebody stuck a housing estate right in the middle of it. So I was surprised about that. It's very difficult to get your bearings if you remember it as one thing and it's turned into another. Usually you can sort of find your way around as long as they don't interfere with the actual length of a street. You can sort of piece it together, you know, but once they start breaking up, you know, breaking a street in half, you know, they're rewriting history.
Yeah.
They don't want us to have a history.
What do you consider to be your greatest work, John?
What poetry wise?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I suppose I'd have to pick the one that's been most successful for me and the one that's opened me the most doors. And that would be Chickens, evidently Chicken Sound.
Yeah, it's a work of art.
Thank you. I like it.
Have you got a mantra as such? Do you have like a phrase that keeps you going? When you get up in the morning, do you have a little manifesto?
What, like chanting? What, like Russell Brand or something? What?
Do you have a little phrase that... that drives you?
Well, I tell you what I get, what I do when I get up in the morning. I pray to God and thank Him for the life I've wound up with. That's what I do every morning without fail. I never forget to be grateful. Thank you for my life.
You're probably the only person I know that doesn't have a mobile phone still. You've not got a phone?
No, I don't have one. Can't it wait?
Yeah, brilliant. Can't it wait? Who are your favourite humans of Manchester ever, John?
Ah, right. Well, the late Albert Finney, certainly. Terrific. Saturday night and Sunday morning, and that's only the beginning of it. But he never got typecast. After that, he never did another kitchen sink part in his entire career. The nearest thing he did to it was probably Gumshoe. Maybe Chet a little bit in Charlie Bubbles, but he never made a bad movie. He was utterly convincing when he was playing an American. I refer you to Miller's Crossing. And I got a soft spot for him because very early on, you know, I went to see that film. I lied about my age. I was told for my age, so I went to see Saturday Night and Sunday Morning. And I thought, what's all the fuss about James Dean? This kid pisses all over that whinging brat. You know, he was greasy, wasn't he? He was greasy and feral. Fantastic. I loved him in that. And he was great in all the follow-ups as well. Tom Jones, Miller's Crossing, Picasso Summer, Two for the Road. You know, some great movies. And but the reason I connected with him was I had a job at school as a bookies runner, which earned me a lot of money for my age. I had a lot of disposable income. Before they legalised off-track betting, I was a bookies runner. And they always picked underage kids, so you couldn't get actually sent to prison. So, you know, all you had to say, you had a spiel worked out. You know, you went there with an envelope full of bets, and then if a cop, in the unlikely event of a cop stopping you, it was like, well, this gentleman gave me a shilling to deliver this envelope, sir. You know, that got you off the hook, you know. But usually they didn't matter. Most of the cops were putting bets on anyway. But it was illegal then, off-track betting. So when they legalised it, who'd been an off-track bookie but Albert Finney Senior. So the day after they legalised off-track betting, it was a black day for me because I lost my job. I was rendered redundant. But it was a good day for Albert Senior. Because his newly successful son opened this swish new betting office on Whit Lane with a bottle green opaque window and gold copper plate lettering, Albert Finney, going diagonally across the window, out and proud. Amazing. You want to put a bet on? This is the place for you.
Brilliant.
So Albert, yeah.
What about the English teacher, Mr. Malone?
Yeah, let's put Mr. Malone in there. He's the guy that opened the literary door, certainly, yeah. Yeah. Because about poetry, the thing about poetry is, and the thing that Mr. Malone understood right away was that poetry is a phonetic medium. That's why I say that music should be written into poetry, because it is a phonetic medium. It's not meant to be read to yourself in a book. How do you know if it's any good unless you read it aloud? You've got no idea what it's like. But Mr. Malone knew this, and so he recited it to you. You know what I mean? So you got it orally before you actually read it, you know? Yeah. And that became that was an early, very valuable lesson to me.
It sounds like he inspired a bunch of kids there proper, didn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a lot different to the way secondary moderns are perceived now, aren't they? You know, this sort of oversimplified idea that we were all just thrown on the social garbage dump. You know, it really wasn't like that at all.
Go on then, give us a poem.
Okay, this is page 11. page 11 on your luckiest guy alive. This one's called The List. A rational dream, a bucket of steam, a riveting piece in Heat magazine, a gay baby in Bethnal Green, none of the above has ever been seen. Chinese cheese, African skis, a technical term for the back of our knees, developers embracing trees, an argument where each side agrees, a sergeant major saying please, you won't find any of these. I think that I shall never see that developer hug that tree, or a pussycat swimming in the deep blue sea, the feminist hooker who splits the fee, the best things in life that come for free, these things remain unknown to me. The pugilist without a fist, the fantasist without a tryst, the onanist without a wrist, the journalist who isn't pissed, all of the above exist on the list of shit that don't exist. I don't think I ever met a state nurse with a private jet, a Presbyterian Bernadette, a bookie wiping out all debts, returning unsuccessful bets, and try to forget what don't necessarily get. Those foam rubber castanets, that health-inducing cigarette, maybe one day, not yet. Kosher ham, vegan spam, a virgin bride with a double pram, a chocolate teapot, a plastic pan, a nylon kettle, a girl named Stan. If I can't find them, no one will.
Genius. Johnny Clark, thank you very much for that. Before we go, John, describe Manchester in three words.
Pissing down again.
Brilliant. Dr. John Cooper Clark, thank you for being a human of Excess Manchester.
Thanks a lot, Clint.
That was Dr. John Cooper Clark. Next week, I'll be joined by founder of the Manchester International Festival, Christine Court, ahead of the launch of this year's festival. Don't forget to follow us on social media and subscribe to Humans of Excess Manchester. Rate us, feel free to leave us a review. We love hearing your feedback. Thanks to our friends at Safer Roads GM for sponsoring this series, and thank you for listening. See you next week.